Just a heads up, today's episode contains a word or two some people may find offensive. This is IRL, Online Life is Real Life, an original podcast from Mozilla. I'm Veronica Belmont.
A horrifying scene in Charlottesville as this car plowed into a crowd of people, the driver then backing up, and witnesses say dragging at least one person. Unite the right.
In August, a protest turned deadly in the American town of Charlottesville, Virginia. After organizing online, a large group of torch-wielding white supremacists descended on the town to protest the removal of a Confederate statue. They had assembled lawfully. They had every right to be there and to express their opinion. And so did a large group of counter-protesters. Things got ugly. And in the end, a woman named Heather Heyer was dead, hit by a car, driven by one of the racist protesters. Laws that govern free expression differ depending on what country you live in. In the United States, freedom of speech is considered a fundamental virtue of democracy. There's a reluctance to restrict a person's right to say what's on their mind. And yet, there's also a belief that free speech should not infringe on the freedom of others. After Charlottesville, this tension manifested itself online, and with the neo-Nazi website The Daily Stormer in particular. The site was accused of further inciting or encouraging violence. It was all too much for a group of tech companies, including GoDaddy, Google, and Cloudflare. They pulled their services, and just like that, the Daily Stormer was offline, exiled to the dark web. Some will say this is an act of common decency, but it also brings up an important question. When large companies own the publication platforms and the plumbing that makes the internet accessible to all of us, should they have the power to control our right to speak? That's what today's episode is exploring, and I have three guests joining me for this conversation. There's Jillian York. She's with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and runs the website onlinecensorship.org. And she's in Berlin, Germany. Hi, Jillian.
Hi.
Also here in the studio with me in San Francisco is Brandi Collins. She's a senior campaign director with Color of Change, an online racial justice organization. Hi, Brandi.
Hi there.
And Anil Dash is joining us from New York. He's a tech entrepreneur and CEO of Fog Creek Software. Hi, Anil.
Hello, glad to be here.
Okay, to start us off, I'd like you to listen to someone who watched the Charlottesville news footage from a perspective very different from ours. His name is Brad Galloway. When Brad was younger, he was part of a skinhead street gang. So here's what he said he noticed most about the alt-right protesters.
If you look at Charlottesville, I was watching the faces of the people that were, you know, in person, offline at the rally, right? And, you know, you can see the ones that are really, really involved. And there's a lot of confused faces I noticed too there. And I would say that those are maybe some guys that were online noticing the advertisements for this rally. And they agreed online to say, yeah, that's a great idea. Like, we should do that. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're actually there in person going, whoa, this is like, you know, this is different than online. Right?
Brad is saying something interesting about how online and offline hate intersects. Anil, how do you react to what Brad's saying here about having people having to confront the reality of what they're saying offline, online?
I think this is something that a lot of our digital platforms sort of have built into them, is that they distance us from the humanity of the people we're talking about. And I think there is a point, you know, hopefully not usually as dramatic as being, you know, a white supremacist, where a lot of people feel, oh, this thing I say online isn't real, doesn't count, it's sort of a game. And I do think there are a lot of circumstances where as soon as things get personal, immediate, human, face-to-face, decent people who may only have made a mistake instead of committing to, you know, being their worst selves, may confront that and have a reckoning with it. And I think we've all had minor versions of that. I mean, I've had whatever, you know, the usual back and forth online debates with somebody on social media, and I'll say, why don't you give me a call? And I'll put my phone number out there, and all of a sudden get a very, very different tone. And I think we're seeing a version of that here.
And Brandy, what sort of questions were you asking after Charlottesville?
I'm not sure I was asking a lot of questions after Charlottesville. I think I was demanding a lot of answers because this isn't something that's been unpredictable, right? I think things that came out afterwards showed that there were actually online discussions that were being had anticipating violence in Charlottesville. So this was not just out of the blue and people were like, hey, you know what? I think I'll take in a nice Confederate flag rally and not expect anything to go down. Like, this is a part of a continued pattern of violence that we've seen throughout our history and particularly has been ramped up in recent months and years.
Jillian, do you think that there's any chance that some of these protesters realize that their online hate speech had consequences beyond maybe what they'd considered?
Yeah, no, I understand exactly what Anil was saying, that I really understand that idea of being a kind of a different person offline than you are online, and that a lot of people do, come out with stuff. I mean, I do it all the time, say stuff on Twitter that I probably wouldn't have the guts to say in person. And of course, you know, I think we have to separate that problem from the actual issue of ideology here, which, you know, is really the root of this.
I think it also is kind of at the root of this whole conversation of the difference between hate speech and free speech. Mm-hmm. And Anil, I know that's not super well defined. Mm-hmm. So where's your line?
You know, I think it depends on context, right? There are things that are legal to say. But specifically, almost all this speech happens on commercial platforms, right? And they've already gone well past, you know, simply saying everything that's legal is allowed on our platforms. There are many, many things that are legal that they don't allow. So they've built technologies to constrain speech for business reasons. Now, the question is what they consider worthy of their protection as a business versus not. And that's a declaration of the values of those companies. I mean, it's as simple as that. If they say, and to the point about free speech, you know, the organizers of a lot of these white nationalist rallies and white supremacist rallies very deliberately and explicitly talk about how they want to use the rhetoric of free speech as a tactic for getting their message out there. And that's something we should be mindful of, is this is what they see as an exploitable value of ours that they can use to grow their base, grow the amount of people sending the money, grow their events. What I think is we haven't really, really reckoned with the fact that it's used as a tool for advancing causes that all of us would agree are destructive.
That actually ties in really well with a comment from Matthew Prince, who's the CEO of Cloudflare. Cloudflare is a service that protects websites from hackers. Vice Magazine actually interviewed him about his decision to kick Daily Stormer off of their service, and he admits that his decision was arbitrary. But, well, let's take a listen with what he said to Vice's managing editor, Michael Moynihan.
I am not shedding a tear that content isn't online anymore. But one of my fellow employees came up to me the day that we took it offline and said, hey, is this the day the internet dies?
There was no due process. You woke up one morning and you said, this is bad and I'm gonna do something about it.
I am deeply concerned that I had the authority and the power to wake up one morning and say, you know what? I'm done. These guys, I'm sick of this. So fuck them. They're off the internet.
Do you have too much power?
What we need to have is a conversation about where is it the right place for tech companies to be regulating the internet?
Brandy, what do you have to say about that?
I think for me, there's always this huge question that the role of Silicon Valley in the climate that we're seeing right now. And I think Anil completely nailed it on the head when he said that, like, when it comes to white nationalism or domestic terrorism, there seems to be a lot more loud than when it comes to other spaces. And for a long time, Silicon Valley has been super hesitant to actually do anything. We have been having hard conversations with these platforms for months before Charlottesville around some of the things that we were seeing online and the internet world that's being created, which in theory, the internet is supposed to be this like really global place where anything's possible. And yet what we see in the way that the bits and bytes and algorithms are developed is that it's actually creating more siloed, more radicalized spaces that are then bleeding offline and having these deep consequences. And so I think what you hear him, I think, going through is like Silicon Valley just now waking up to, oh, we do have a role to play here. But what is that role, I think, is one that they still seem to be struggling with.
Yeah, it seems like the tech industry, which I am a part of, you know, we've created these platforms, and yet we don't fully understand the repercussions of the rules we make around those platforms. But Jillian, it sounds like he admits here that his decision creates a problem, but he still stands by what he did. How much of a problem is it, really?
So I really understand what he's saying because, you know, I also didn't have any sympathy. I mean, I think I'm in Germany. The word that describes best what I experienced that day was Schadenfreude. You know, I wasn't upset at all to see these platforms kicked off, and yet I'm a free speech advocate. This is my job. I think what's really interesting is that we're seeing this conversation coming up around the issue because these white supremacists got censored. Last year, Twitter kicked off more than 200,000 accounts that were allegedly supporting terrorism with no transparency around what that was, about who those people were, what exactly they were saying, you know, and I've seen people have their accounts removed for, you know, I'm doing air quotes right now, for supporting terrorism when what they were actually doing was mocking terrorism or engaging in counter speech. And so for me, really, what Matthew raises there, I agree with. The question is, okay, if we are to agree that companies have to do this, and, you know, it is their bottom line, they're corporations, they have the right to regulate speech as they see fit, as it stands right now, we need to be putting processes in place so that users have the right to appeal, so that companies are transparent about who exactly they're taking down.
Yeah, I want to be a little skeptical, too, about what Matthew said, because I run a software company. We host content on our platforms. I've run social media platforms and used Cloudflare, their product. And there's a couple of things that come out of this. One of is all of a sudden he's saying, we have so much power. How do we deal with this power? What's our transparent process? What do we do about this? This has been true from day one of that company's existence, right? And I say this as a customer and somebody that likes their services. They've always had that power. And the question is why they didn't reckon with it before. But I think in Silicon Valley, they've been fighting really, really hard for decades now to take powers that were formerly things we abdicated to regulation, to policy, to governance, and put it in their ball court and say, we control this. We control this at the software layer, at the technology layer, and we don't want to have regulators or policymakers be in charge of this, even though they have a mature process that's been around for, in some cases, centuries. And as soon as it gets hard and tricky and they're being held accountable, they're like, whoa, let's put this back in the courts and back with the lawmakers. And all of a sudden, we don't want to be in charge of this stuff. And then as soon as it gets challenging to moderate, regulate, oversee, engage, be literate enough in these issues, they're like, well, we can't afford to do that. We want the public to pay for doing that. It's like, well, you made all the money off of this. Some of that should go towards, well, having to deal with the repercussions.
Some argue that decisions like this cross a line, that it's not a company's business to decide what is and isn't allowed to be said or done on their platforms or by using their services. I want you to hear this clip from Nick Lim. He's the CEO of BitMitigate, and they're actually a lot like Cloudflare. We talked to Nick about why he made the decision to offer their services to Daily Stormer after all this went down.
First, I'm Asian, so I mean, I'm a clear target of their hate speech, so I think it's clear to see that I definitely don't agree with it. I think it's a stupid idea, but frankly, it's not my place to decide for all people, and I just serve as a technological infrastructure to provide free speech for all people, as long as it's legal. I think that if I weren't to have stepped up, I think this would have been real concerning because then it would have been a significant point in history where big corporations have really dictated the course of content and communications on the internet.
So, Jillian, what do you have to say to that? How is this? Does this count under free speech in your mind?
You know, I'm torn, but at the same time, I do agree with his point that I don't want these unelected, undemocratic companies making these decisions. But when we're talking about Facebook and Twitter, I mean, look at these companies; they have very little diversity within them. We're talking about companies that have less than 25% women at them. And then when you break that down through different races and whatnot, there's really not a lot of diversity in Silicon Valley in the first place. So you've got these people making decisions not just for Americans, but then for the rest of the world as well, and then exporting those rules. And so, you know, just to throw a non-hate speech example in there, you know, Facebook for a long time has said men are okay topless, women are not. You know, and that's a decision that to me is very American and very male, frankly. It's not a decision that I'm comfortable with, and it's not a decision that most Europeans I talk to about this are comfortable with. And so they're exporting their values, and I think that, you know, kind of shows through in this. So no, I mean, I don't want companies to be making these decisions. I don't want private actors who are unaccountable to me making those kinds of decisions about speech.
And Brandy, is he right? How hands-off should technology companies be on these issues of free speech?
I think it's interesting that he says that we're at this critical juncture because I think we've flown past that. Corporations are already making decisions around what type of content gets put in front of us. And as he was talking, I was thinking about this quick example. So I have three computers, one for work, one for personal, and then one that's sort of for work, but that I use to look at hate groups, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of did this experiment for myself. Like, what if the machine thinks I'm a white male with maybe, you know, white nationalist leanings, what kind of internet experience do I have? And I got to tell you, it's a radically different experience than the one that I have on my regular computer. The type of content that's put in front of me, the sort of ads that I get for guns, the different news stories that look to reinforce this ideology, it's like set in front of me. It's created this world where there's not even an opportunity to see the other side of that.
Yeah, and I do want to talk, too, about the way they sort of talk out of both sides of their mouth. I think Nick Lim is a perfect example of this, where his first reaction to the fact that he was hosting the Daily Stormer is he found it really entertaining and that it got publicity for his company. The thing to keep in mind is he offered to host the Daily Stormer for these white supremacists after they were kicked off of other services. So their credential was they were too extreme and had incited too much violence for other services in Silicon Valley to find them acceptable, and that was why he took them in. We talk around it because we can, to the earlier point, fall back on the rhetoric of free speech and fall back on, well, I want to make sure I'm not the one that's the arbiter. Well, the arbiter is the person who takes them in and gives them shelter, right? When I used to host other kinds of content, I came close to that myself. Like, gosh, who am I to say what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong? And the truth is, we all are. We all set our boundaries. We all are accountable and responsible for what we do. And certainly to seek out the worst of the worst and say, I want to give you sanctuary, is to subsidize them. And that has a higher bar. That has an element of accountability and culpability that we treat as equivalent to the, I didn't know this was here and nobody had flagged it and nobody reported it, which is a very different circumstance.
This is IRL, Online Life is Real Life, an original podcast from Mozilla. I'm Veronica Belmont. I wanted to jump back a little bit into this idea of corporate spaces on the web as platforms for our speech. And we talked to internet law professor and writer Jonathan Zittrain for his perspective on this. So he thinks it's more of an issue of whether or not what you have to say will actually be heard by anyone.
It's easier to get a message out today than it's ever been in the course of humanity. Think Facebook or Twitter or Medium.com. But often these platforms are also in the business of steering people who want to get the content to point them in one direction or another. You're free to post a note on Facebook, but it might well be a tree that falls in a forest that no one hears. If Facebook should choose to promote that in other people's feeds, or Twitter chooses to make a tweet something that appears high up in people's Twitter streams, that can direct a ton of attention. And that then, without any influence by a government, suggests the kind of power that just a few platform hosts might have in steering people to some content over others. And that's harder to describe as outright censorship or even blocking of speech, not only because there's not maybe a government involved in this instance, but because nothing's being cut off. It's just what's being emphasized that, of course, by its nature will de-emphasize everything else. And these are the kinds of battles that have been fought before, but with smaller stakes and over a more distributed media environment. And that's something we have yet to really contend with.
I think this is especially fascinating now that, Brandy, you've discussed how you went online as a completely different person and experienced almost a completely different internet just by the information you were putting out there into the world. So how much do you think this could be a bigger problem, that as social platforms keep maturing and keep deciding what content deserves more attention, that the free expression of smaller groups and marginalized individuals gets buried under the weight of everything else?
I absolutely think that we're going in this direction, and added to that, the ability to sort of pay more to get to more exposure, you see this become less what this platform was intended to be under this sort of concept of net neutrality and the Internet of Things, and more becoming a space of the elite.
The queer community has been complaining about this for a long time. Facebook doesn't necessarily understand the difference between the uses of reclaimed words versus the use of slurs.
Yeah.
And so they have responded to this, but there was a sort of a systematic takedown of posts that contained the word dyke. And several of the people that I spoke to who experienced this said that the post that they'd put out there that was taken down had maybe, 100 people who had access to it. They were friends only. They didn't suppose that anyone within their friend group had reported it. And so their suspicion, and again, not confirmed, but their suspicion was that that was in some way algorithmic.
How fair is it to even suggest that tech companies have to bear this responsibility of protecting free speech at all costs? Aren't these companies allowed to make money and grow based off their own missions and values? I mean, there's this bottom line that they have to look out for, too. So, Anil, what do you think?
I think if we want to foist responsibility for these things onto anyone, it should probably be organizations that are among the wealthiest and most powerful institutions that have ever existed in history. And fortunately, that describes Facebook and Google and Apple and all these other companies. So it isn't unfair to ask these incredibly wealthy companies to do a little bit more. The problem is they've never even been asked. And so I think there's this this interesting thing where the same company, the same people who say we can put a self-driving car on the moon and we can, build like any technology you can imagine. As soon as you talk to them about, well, can you make a community where people aren't openly hostile towards one another and the voices of the marginalized aren't squashed down? And they're like, wow, that's science fiction. That seems too hard for me.
It really does feel like they're like throwing their hands up in the air and going, yeah. No, this is beyond us. This is impossible.
Who can conceive of such a
thing?
Who
can even think of
it? Done? Right.
We're just neutral technology companies. We can't do anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, we've been in at Color Change with our partners at Center for Media Justice and some of us and others in conversations with Facebook, like well over 2 years around bullying in their community. I think our first entry point was that some smaller groups we were working with, there were hate groups on Facebook that were posting the information of people and where they work and where they live, and like people were showing up with guns. So again, this stuff has been happening for a while, and the whole time it's been resistance around that and always the onus on us to like figure it out, and instead of on these like billion-dollar companies to get it right.
This is the thing that baffles me the most about the free speech argument. And Jillian, maybe you can help me with this, because I'm a podcaster. I don't know, but tell me where I'm right and where I'm wrong here. But that free speech kind of ends when you incite violence against a person or a group.
I do think that it's really important that we draw the line between what is incitement and what is hate speech. And I think that hate speech is a much trickier subject. You know, what is just hateful speech, speech that is, nasty and but doesn't necessarily have those kinds of consequences. Speech that hurts feelings, sure, but doesn't have the same kind of violent consequences. And then speech that is actually dangerous, speech that can call for genocide, speech that can call for violence against individuals. But unfortunately, what's happened in Silicon Valley, at least, is that they've kind of put all of this stuff under the bucket of hate speech, and then they're trying to grapple with all of these different things. They're trying to enforce rules that they don't even have to have in the first place. But then when it comes to the really, really serious stuff that has consequences, that's when they seem to throw their hands up the most. And I'm baffled by it, honestly.
I definitely had those points where we were like Facebook, we have to take down these people's profile pictures because they're showing breastfeeding, and that's, an issue. And then on the same platform, we had people who were sort of self-avowed Nazis and really towing the line about what they were doing to threaten people. And we'd be like, gosh, well, that's just free speech. And I mean, I was, I was not senior enough to actually have authority over it, but I was sort of amenable to those arguments. And after a while, I started to feel like, am I nuts here? Like, this seems totally backwards. Like, I don't care about somebody showing a picture of breastfeeding. I care a lot about somebody threatening somebody's life over their identity. And what I realized later was, the primary consideration was really stuff like advertising. And most of the large networks are ad-supported. So the advertisers have these rules around what they'll show. The thing that we often forget is a lot of the most hateful, hurtful groups, the most threatening groups online are very, very sophisticated. They know how the networks work. They they understand the boundaries of things like advertisers or whatever. So they'll flag their stuff as, you know, don't put ads on this, or this is adult content, or it's private or whatever. And then as far as the hosting companies, the platforms are concerned, they're like, oh, okay, well, then that, we don't need to censor that. We don't need to worry about that because it's not going to affect our ad dollars. Meanwhile, the other people who are like sharing pictures of their kids or something and they happen to be breastfeeding in it, they want to be out there. They want to be sharing their content with their friends. They want to be, you know, sort of discoverable to the world. And all of a sudden, they're the ones where the advertisers are freaked out, or ostensibly would be, right? Because the algorithm is the thing sort of detecting, is this the sort of thing an advertiser might take offense to?
Hashtag free the nips, Anil. You got to free the nips. I'm Veronica Belmont, and this is IRL, a podcast from Mozilla. I'm changing pace a little bit here, and we touched on it a little bit earlier. It's a question about how the technologies we've created can accidentally block free speech without even meaning to, and I think Jillian brought it up, especially with the LGBTQ community. So one example, of course, is when YouTube introduced parental controls to its service a few years ago, and they meant well. As so many companies do, but in the process, a bunch of content ended up being accidentally restricted. Tegan Quinn from the rock group Tegan and Sarah found that some of their music videos had actually been completely blocked, and we asked her about it.
So the moment that I read online that some of our videos were being restricted under the new parental controls on YouTube, I was horrified. And as I started sort of searching through YouTube, trying to find our music videos, I realized like a lot of our videos had been blocked, specifically a song called Alligator and a song called I Was a Fool. They have no content in it that could have possibly been seen as offensive. One is us dancing around in snowsuits with a bunch of other people in snowsuits. Like, it wasn't suggestive. It wasn't queer. I mean, the only thing queer in these videos was us. I also at that time spoke to some other LGBTQ artists whose content was being blocked. And I actually found what most intrigued me was that their record labels or managers were telling them not to call out YouTube because they were afraid that YouTube would, I don't know, create some sort of list of people who had, you know, gone after them or whatever. And I was like, that's ridiculous.
So ultimately, YouTube realized what went wrong and took steps to fix the problem. But Jillian, here you have band managers and record labels allegedly telling artists to self-censor so they don't stir the pot and end up on some kind of blacklist. What does that say to you about the challenges that we all still face in understanding how free speech does and doesn't work online?
Oh, yeah, no, that's such a tough question. I'm still picking myself up off the floor because I love Tegan and Sarah so much.
Fangirl squee. Yeah, totally.
Who doesn't? You would have to be pretty terrible not to.
I'm swooning over here. No, I mean, I think, you know, this has been a question for a long time. I mean, just to bring in kind of my international perspective on this, one of the things that a lot of these companies like to use as an excuse, and I know Anil's been talking about the business side, Brandy brought that up as well, but a lot of, you know, if you look at Facebook's community guidelines around sexuality, and I have these almost memorized, which is why I'm focusing on that and not YouTube, they're basically saying, we don't allow nudity because then Saudi Arabia is going to block us. And I know that maybe that is hyperbole, but I've heard, you know, from kind of insiders that, in fact, they have gotten those kinds of threats before that they don't do this or that. And so I think that, you know, it says a lot. And it concerns me that we're kind of ending up with this really flattened version of what free speech is.
And Brandy, self-censorship like this really does predate the internet as well. But do you wonder if the way the web works today makes this a bigger or different problem than previously?
Yeah. As I was listening to that, I was sort of reminded, oh, this is why I don't post prolifically online as much, because there doesn't seem to be room for nuance online. And so there's all of this space around how we have this conversation around monitoring free speech online. And I always feel weird about having a conversation about free speech as a woman and a person of color, because I feel like free speech in the U.S. is only free for those who can afford to pay the cost.
Anil, what do you think of that, of what Brandy and Jillian are saying?
It's very telling that there's this huge chilling effect of people wondering, what are these networks, what are these giant social media companies and tech companies going to allow me to publish? And part of it is the content creators, whether they're making videos or writing or whatever else they're doing, feel dependent. Like, if you don't have a presence on Facebook, you don't have a presence on YouTube, can you be out there in the world? Are you even going to exist? Are you going to risk getting silently sort of squelched by these platforms? You can't afford to take that risk. And certainly I don't want Saudi Arabia's standards to dictate the world's standards for how we communicate with each other.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you know, I wish that Saudi Arabia would at least bar white supremacists, because then the social networks here in America would presumably have to follow. But I think that there could be some sort of
possible solution.
Yeah, exactly. My other solution was that the major record labels could record each of the common forms of hate speech as pop singles and copyright them. And then whenever anybody uses those slurs, they would have to take it down because it would be violating the record label's copyright. But I don't know if that would work.
This is outside the box thinking. I like it. We're coming up with ideas here. We're just spitballing.
Exactly.
This disconnect we can see of how we understand free speech online versus free speech offline. Where do you want this conversation to go from here for all of us? Jillian, what do you think?
On a more specific prescription, I want to see these companies start to put in place due process. And so if you are, you know, a user who is wrongly taken down, or a marginalized group that's affected by, you know, bad algorithms and things like that, there's no way that you can appeal that. And that's something that I think that companies could have done yesterday and just have no will to do.
Anil?
I want to see direct action from ordinary citizens. And, you know, it takes a long time to pull these things off. I look at analogies like the slow food movement or the organic food movement. And, you know, at the time they were sort of derided as being wild-eyed extremists and nobody ever cares about this stuff. And now you walk into Whole Foods and it tells you the farm where your apple was raised on and how far it flew to get to your store, right? So change can happen, and sometimes it takes years or decades, but there is a very, very large audience of people starting to think of information and our digital diets in a similar way as something that we can take control of, have agency over, that we can expect it to be sourced ethically. And, you know, everybody that cares about fair trade coffee beans should certainly care about the working conditions of the people that build the technologies they use and the effects that those technologies have on their communities.
And Brandy, what do you think?
I really want to see corporations feel urgency to get this right before people die. And it's really unfortunate that it takes someone getting run over by a car before these corporations act prudently. I really love these like mass mobilization efforts. I would love to see what that looks like in terms of adding that sort of corporate push and pressure that forces them to sort of reevaluate what they're willing and able to do for the sake of their bottom line.
Figuring out if we should or shouldn't place limits on free expression online isn't easy. Even with today's episode, I feel like we've really only scratched the surface. There's a lot more to this and more viewpoints to consider. Take Nick Lim's perspective, the CEO of BitMitigate we heard from earlier. He's not alone in believing that democracy thrives when everyone is free to share ideas and opinions. That free speech must be protected at all costs.
Well, the fact of the matter is you can't stop an idea, you can only change its form. And for example, the Daily Stormer is still online. They've been pushed off a lot of domains, registrars, but their content is still online under the dark web, and it actually is now unregulatable and it's unstoppable. So it's only gotten stronger in that regard. So I think a lot of people's interest, while in good interest, have been extremely counterproductive. And now the platform is substantially more advanced.
But there's no absolute answer. I'm not sure that there ever can be. At least we're able to have these conversations and try to strike a balance. There are people in countries around the world who have never had the freedom to speak their minds. And I want you to hear one last thought from internet pioneer and Mozilla chair Mitchell Baker. She has a perspective on how this conversation fits into the evolution of the web as a whole.
So I think we're just incredibly early in understanding what networking humanity means. And so I guess in some ways it's not surprising that these questions of social norms and what's decent and what's civil behavior and what does a society expect and how does it both protect individuals expressing themselves and protect individuals from violence are coming up all over again. Because we have these new tools and technologies of such powerful nature. And so I don't for any minute think that the label free speech means that a community interested in civility and health and nonviolence is required to do nothing. Right? That person's right to free speech does not mean that a community can't build norms or can't associate or can't decide that is unacceptable behavior. I don't want to have anything to do with it. And figure out how to actually move forward.
So, what do you think? Freedom of speech is important, online and off. Should it have limits? Who draws those limits? Tell me what role you think us regular internet citizens should play to help create a more free, civil, and healthy internet. Head to the IRL Podcast website and check out the show notes to find ways to reach out. IRLpodcast.org. A big thank you to my guest today for having this conversation and giving us lots to think about. Brandi Collins is with Color of Change. Jillian York is with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the website onlinecensorship.org. And Anil Dash is the CEO of Fog Creek Software. That's a wrap on the first season of IRL. If you've just discovered us, there are 6 other action-packed episodes for you to indulge in, and the themes play well with some of what we talked about today. We sent delicious cakes to online trolls, spoke with hackers about our insecure web, I had a private investigator dig up what he could about me online, and it was truly a serious case of TMI. We even destroyed a children's toy to protect us from online spies. Not at all, because she was totally creepy. Lots to learn and lots to enjoy, so look us up online or in your podcast player and dive into the archive. Meanwhile, we're going to take a bit of a break to clear our caches, update our passwords, and refresh our browsers before coming back for season 2. So stay subscribed and stay tuned, and I'll be back before you know it. IRL is an original podcast from Mozilla, the nonprofit behind the Firefox browser. I'm Veronica Belmont. Thanks for listening. I'll see you online until we catch up again next season, IRL. Keep scrolling, 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 scrolling. Come on, keep scrolling, 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 scrolling. Yeah. Now you're going to have to pay Limp Bizkit a, like, licensing fee. No, it's parody.